This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Pariskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajeem. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Mathalu alladhina yunfiquna amwalahum fi sabilillah. كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of a grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every ear. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran's foreign minister says Tehran and Ankara are convinced that, quote, the only way to restore stability in the region is through synergy. The UN says 92 million people in the EU still live in poverty as inequality levels have not improved since the 2008 financial crisis. The World Health Organization warns that hoarding of COVID-19 vaccines by some countries keeps the pandemic burning. It's good to have you with us. Our top story, Iran's foreign minister says Tehran and Ankara have a common stance that the only way to restore stability in the region is through synergy. Mohammad Javad Zarif hailed his talks with Turkey's president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, and foreign minister, Mevlut Cavusoglu, as constructive, friendly, and fruitful. Zarif also noted that ways to expand bilateral ties, regional cooperation, and the latest developments in Syria, Iraq, and the Caucasus were among the main topics discussed in the talks. Iran's top diplomat made the remarks in a Twitter post at the end of his visit to Turkey.
Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif says it is the duty of the U.S. to return to the 2015 nuclear deal and fulfill its obligations under the accord. In a joint press conference with his Turkish counterpart, Zarif underlined that the moment the United States fulfills its commitments, Iran would be prepared to fulfill ours.
It is the duty of the United States to return to this agreement and to fulfill its obligations. The moment the United States fulfills its commitments, we would prepare to fulfill ours.
Zarif also denounced a U.S. decision last month to slap sanctions on Turkey over the country's purchase of the S-400 Russian air defense system. He said the sanctions have no significance. Elsewhere in his remarks, Zarif hailed relations with Turkey, noting that ties will deepen when the U.S. adopts more reasonable attitudes. For his part, Cavusoglu said Turkey has always supported the nuclear deal, expressing the hope that the Biden administration would return to the JCPOA and lift sanctions on Iran.
I hope that with the Biden administration, the United States return to this agreement and cooperation on the nuclear issue is restored. In this way, God willing, the sanctions and embargoes imposed on brotherhood Iran are lifted.
Zarif arrived in Turkey as part of a tour of countries of the South Caucasus, aimed at building support for the creation of a regional platform that would include Armenia, Azerbaijan, Georgia, Iran, Russia, and Turkey, and encourage cooperation between the countries. The initiative was proposed following a ceasefire agreement in November that halted weeks of conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan over the separatist territory of Nagorno-Karabakh.
I think the meeting was very important. Both sides have a lot in common and many issues were discussed regionally and economically. The most important issue on the agenda was the Iran nuclear deal. And now with the new U.S. administration, there is a hope for this deal to be revived.
Zarif also met with Turkish President Erdogan, where the two discussed expansion of bilateral ties, as well as regional cooperation in Syria, Iraq, Caucasus, and ways to restore stability in the region through synergy. This meeting is seen by many as a door to open negotiations between Turkey and the U.S. to revive the 2015 nuclear deal. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
At top 8, U.S. President Joe Biden says the new administration's priority is to deal with what he calls an escalating nuclear crisis with Iran. The White House National Security Advisor claimed that Tehran is moving, quote, closer to having enough fissile material for a nuclear weapon. Jake Sullivan made the remarks as the Biden administration has signaled it wants to re-enter the Iran nuclear deal. The previous administration had abandoned. Sullivan did not mention Biden's oft-stated precondition that Iran make the first move by rolling back its commitments under the deal. Iran has underlined that it was the United States that unilaterally pulled out of the 2015 deal and therefore it needs to take the first step by lifting sanctions and complying with the terms of the agreement. Jason Anure is a political commentator and he joins us now. Jason, welcome. Sullivan is describing it as an escalating nuclear crisis. Who escalated this crisis?
Well, frankly, I would even question whether or not it's even an escalating crisis. I think that this is just a situation that has not really changed very much, at least since the initial departure from the agreement. Iran has gone on a steady incline in increasing the amount of nuclear material, but it's not some major international crisis as it appears that the United States is trying to make it out to be. I think that this is a very simple situation. The United States is the one who left the agreement. They are the ones who sabotaged the good faith agreement that existed, yet expects Iran to be the one who makes the gesture, the overture to return to a more stable and peaceful situation. But it was the United States who was the one who actually violated the agreement. So the way that this is phrased is as though Iran did something wrong. Why should Iran trust the United States on a return to the agreement? Why should they have to take the first step when they were not the ones who left it? It was the U.S. People are questioning the commitment and the solidarity that the United States has to the agreement. And even then, Iran has taken no terribly radical action that would place anyone in danger anywhere in the global situation. So the U.S. is very, very misleading in right. The way that it has presented the situation.
Now, Jason, Iran says the sanctions imposed under the previous White House were harmful and deadly to ordinary Iranians. Even during the pandemic, the country argues it can't import vital medical supplies. Do you believe the current administration acknowledges this? And does it realize that the priority for Iran now is the removal of the sanctions before the U.S. returns to the JCPOA?
I'm certain that they realize it, but I don't think that's something they're going to bring up to the table. I think that this current administration is probably going to try to use the existing sanctions that were unjustly placed by the previous administration of Trump to try to force Iran back to the table to an agreement that Iran has already said that they are willing to go back to. As long as everything returned to the normal state of things that were originally achieved under the JCPOA. At the same time, we have the top military commander of Israel essentially threatening an invasion of Iran if the U.S. actually removes those sanctions. There's too many unjust sanctions on Iran, particularly with regards to medical technology. For example, any medical equipment necessary to fight the COVID-19 pandemic, and Israel is, at least their top general is saying that they'll attack Iran if the U.S. Reduces these unjust sanctions to begin with. So I think that the onus very much is here on the United States to acknowledge that it is in the wrong in this situation, primarily due to the actions of the previous president that was running the country.
Jason, thank you very much for that. Jason Anure, political commentator, joining us out of Ontario. Now, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty says 92 million people in the European Union still live in poverty.
The pandemic did increase inequalities and shall increase inequalities much further, because the peak of poverty figures will probably be reached in the autumn of 2021, when a large number of companies will fall bankrupt. But between 2008, 2009, and 2020, there was barely any change in the figures of inequality. So we've been growing, we've been creating jobs, but not reducing inequality significantly.
Descartes said 20% of the EU citizens are affected by poverty, while inequality levels have not improved since the 2008 economic crisis. He said even more troublesome is that the EU has a growing number of the working poor, people who work but are paid too low wages and thus are at risk of poverty. The UN expert said the working poor make up 9% of the bloc's workforce, describing it as extremely problematic. Professor of Economics David Barkin says the European Union needs to rethink about some of its economic structures to overcome its poverty crisis.
I think that the forces in Europe are moving in the direction of providing very, very small amounts of assistance that will not get to the root causes of the problem, which are the structure of production, the structure of employment, and the lack of a real reinvigoration of economic development that will direct itself toward attending the needs of the lower half of the populations. I think that there's a need for a mass political rethinking.
Italian workers have gone on strike to protest over the government's handling of the COVID crisis. Max Cividi has more in this report.
Public and private sector workers staged a nationwide 24-hour general strike to denounce government measures adopted to counter the spread of coronavirus disease in Italy. The industrial action, called by the Confederation of Base Unions, COBAS, was joined by public servants and self-employed workers in several cities, including Milan, Rome, and Naples. In a note, unions have explained that the ongoing health crisis has exacerbated a structural crisis of the capitalist economy, with a generalized impoverishment and a worsening of living conditions for millions of male and female workers. Also, students and teachers of Italian high schools held rallies in Rome and other cities, demanding a prompt return to the classroom after almost 10 months of remote learning.
We are staging a protest to reiterate that schools must be a priority in this country. Just a small amount of the recovery fund is destined to the school system. Students are sick and tired of distance learning and are dropping out of schools. Many are falling victim to depression.
Students across Italy have been holding demonstrations, open-air lessons and strikes in protest over the adoption of the distance learning policy by the government in response to a second wave of COVID-19 in October. About 10 million students have been affected by coronavirus restrictions in Italy, while schools have remained open in most European countries.
We demand more classrooms, transport to school, and better access to education. Distance learning is not working. Many families cannot afford providing digital devices to their children to attend internet lessons regularly. Our families get poorer by the day as our parents lose their jobs.
As if the COVID crisis and its grave effects on the Italians weren't enough, Italy has also been hit by a political crisis, with Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte resigning earlier this week, forcing the country's head of state to start a round of formal consultations with all political groups to establish if a new government majority can be formed.
Talks between Italy's President Sergio Mattarella and party leaders to resolve the government crisis concluded on Friday, with the country on the brink of a crashing socio-economic failure. President Mattarella must now decide on the way forward and ensure Italy a new government. Max Civili, Rome.
The World Health Organization has warned that hoarding of COVID-19 vaccine supplies, quote, keeps the pandemic burning.
If we hoard vaccines and if we're not sharing, there will be three major problems. One, I said it, it will be a catastrophic moral failure. And two, it keeps the pandemic burning. And three, very slow economic, global economic recovery.
Tedros said the world needs to diversify the supply chain for making COVID-19 vaccines and that the organization is looking at other suppliers. Earlier, the European Commission set strict vaccine export controls as the European Union faces problems with its inoculation program due to supply hiccups. The move taking effect on Saturday obliges pharmaceutical firms to obtain authorization before sending shots manufactured within the EU to other countries. Brussels says the challenges it is facing have left it with no alternative. More than 90 countries are exempted from the restrictions, but the list does not include the United States and the United Kingdom. Brexit was a defining moment in Britain's political history and a real opportunity, many hoped, of the UK retaking its place as a leading voice on the world stage, free from the constraints of the EU. Now, a month in, has stepping away from Brussels shown immediate results? Emina Tatum has a closer look.
After years of campaigning, round after round of tough negotiations with the EU, deadlines pushed back and a no deal averted in the nick of time, January the 1st was a moment of triumph for those who both supported the UK's exit from Europe and for those who simply wanted to move on from the diplomatic drama. But flash forward a month into the UK's new relationship with Europe, and even though it's still early days, how's it working out?
Brexit was touted in certain quarters as Britain's Independence Day, a real opportunity to retake sovereignty from the clutches of the European Union. But now, with some time settling in, just what are the realities of Britain's exit from the EU?
Brexit has clearly caused a lot of short-term chaos, basically, particularly with the fisheries exports and with the supply of food into this country. It's been a huge amount of disruption because of the extra red tape. The irony was that the Brexiteers said we are going to lose all these regulations and red tape and we'll be free to do things, whereas in fact there's a whole mountain of stuff that companies have to complete and all has to be correct in order for really the most basic things to happen.
Boris Johnson and his cabinet have been adamant. This is a new dawn for the UK, a genuine opportunity to flex its political muscles on the global stage. Teething problems have dented this bonhomie somewhat, with businesses trading with the EU pointing to new obstacles.
What we haven't been prepared for, and I think this applies to any business in the UK, is all the extra costs that have come from this.
Industries like fisheries have been particularly impacted, with worried businesses taking their grievance directly to Westminster.
Once the customs stuff's done, it's back onto the lorry can then leave, down for the ferry, make sure we got our import declarations done as well, onto the ferry and on the other side. Could be another 30 hours, extra for the shellfish in the water. It's not feasible.
The new trade deals that will replace anything lost in the split with Brussels have yet to publicly materialize.
All this nonsense talk about sovereignty and how now we're a free and independent country. On the contrary, we had great protection within the European Union. We were in the biggest trading bloc in the world, which not only meant we could trade freely with them, but also they had clout of the EU negotiating on our behalf and on behalf of the other 27 states for trade deals with other countries in the world. Whereas these days, just imagine what China and indeed the United States will think about Little Britain coming cap in hand.
There have been political complications too, with Scotland pushing ahead stridently for another independence vote as a campaign of reunification is being talked down in Ireland by unionists. Ardent Brexiteers will say moving away from the EU is more than about the nuts and bolts of red tape and temporary obstacles, but about a return to something greater, a renewed sense of pride that you can't put a price on. But for those battling with the new realities, they may well wonder if it's a price worth paying. Amina Taylor, London.
That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
An IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee, and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O, the most merciful.
In the limelight.
The video's title was posed as a question, but it left little doubt about where the men who filmed the video actually stood. They called it the coming civil war. And in its opening seconds, Jim Arroyo, who leads an Arizona chapter of Oath Keepers, a right-wing militia, declared that the conflict had already begun. To back up his claim, Mr. Arroyo cited Republican Representative Paul Gosar of Arizona, one of the most far-right members of U.S. Congress. Paul Gosar had paid a visit to the local Oath Keepers chapter a few years earlier, Mr. Arroyo recounted, and when asked if the United States was headed for a civil war, the congressman's response to the group was just flat out, "We're in it already. We just haven't started shooting at each other yet." The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Luke Broadwater and Matthew Rosenberg. The piece is titled, Republican Ties to Extremist Groups Are Under Scrutiny. Stay with us for more of Luke Broadwater and Matthew Rosenberg's article. The video's title was posed as a question, but it left little doubt about where the men who actually made the video stood. They called it the coming civil war. And in its opening seconds, Jim Arroyo, who leads an Arizona chapter of Oath Keepers, a right-wing militia group, declared that the conflict had already begun. To back up his claim, Mr. Arroyo cited Republican Representative Paul Gosar of Arizona, one of the most far-right members of Congress. Mr. Gosar had paid a visit to the local Oath Keepers chapter a few years earlier, Mr. Arroyo recounted, and when asked if the United States was heading for a civil war, the congressman Paul Gosar's response to the group was just flat out, "We're in it already. We just haven't started shooting at each other yet." Less than 2 months after the video was posted, members of the Oath Keepers were among those with links to extremist groups from around the country who took part in the 6th of January attack on the Capitol building in Washington, prompting new scrutiny on the links between members of Congress and an array of organizations and movements that espouse far-right beliefs. Nearly 150 House Republicans supported former President Donald Trump's baseless claims that the election has been stolen from him. But Paul Gosar and a handful of other Republican members of the House had deeper ties to extremist groups who pushed violent ideas and conspiracy theories, and whose members were prominent among those who stormed the halls of Congress in an effort to stop certification of President-elect Joseph R. Biden Jr.'s victory. Their ranks include Representative Andy Biggs of Arizona, who, like Paul Gosar, was linked to Stop the Steal campaign, backing Donald Trump's efforts to overturn the election's outcome. Representative Lauren Boebert of Colorado has also close connections to militia groups, including the so-called Three Percenters, an extreme offshoot of the gun rights movement that had at least one member who entered the Capitol building on Wednesday, 6th of January. Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene has promoted the QAnon conspiracy theory, whose adherents were among the most visible of those storming the building, and she appeared at a rally with various militia groups. Before being elected to Congress last year, Marjorie Taylor Greene used social media in 2019 to endorse executing top Democrats, and has suggested that the 2018 shooting at the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, was actually a false flag attack. The liberal group Media Matters for America reported on Thursday that Marjorie Taylor Greene also speculated on Facebook in 2018 that California wildfires might have been started by lasers from space, promoting a theory pushed by followers of QAnon. Representative Matt Gaetz of Florida appeared last year at an event also attended by members of the Proud Boys, another extremist organization whose role in the 6th of January assault on the Capitol building, like those of Oath Keepers and Three Percenters, is currently being investigated by the FBI. It is not clear whether any elected officials played a role in directly facilitating the attack on the Capitol, other than helping to incite violence through false statements about the election being stolen from Donald Trump. Officials have said they're investigating reports from Democrats that a number of House Republicans provided tours of the Capitol building and other information to people who might have gone on to be part of the mob which attacked the Capitol building the following day, 6th of January. So far, no evidence has surfaced publicly to back up these claims. Ms. Boebert of Colorado said in a statement that she had never given a tour of U.S. Capitol to anyone besides family members in town for my swearing-in, and she called accusations from Democrats that she gave a reconnaissance tour to insurgents as irresponsible lies. After the riot at the Capitol on 6th of January, she said she did not support unlawful actions and acts of violence. Andy Biggs has denied associating with Stop the Steal organizers and condemned the violence of any kind. Were you aware of any planned demonstrations or riots at the U.S. Capitol to take place after the rally on 6th of January 2021? No, Mr. Biggs said in a statement. A spokesman for Marjorie Taylor Greene said she now rejects QAnon and he tried to distance her from militia members. Marjorie Taylor Greene doesn't have anything to do with it, her communications director Nick Dyer said of QAnon. She thinks it's disinformation. For the militia members, he said, those people were at one event independently of Congresswoman Greene. Paul Gosar did not respond to requests for comment. Matt Gaetz, on his podcast, said the Proud Boys were at an event he attended to provide security, and that just because you take a picture with someone, it does not mean you're tied to every viewpoint they've ever had or that they will ever have in the future. But in signaling either overt or tacit support, a small but vocal band of Republicans now serving in the House of Representatives provided legitimacy and publicity to extremist groups and movements as they built towards their role in supporting Donald Trump's efforts to subvert the outcome of the 2020 presidential election and the attack on the Capitol building. Aiton Goldman, a former federal prosecutor who helped convict the Oklahoma City bomber Timothy McVeigh, said that when elected officials or even candidates for office took actions like appearing with militia groups or other right-wing groups, it provides them with an added imprimatur of legitimacy. An examination of many of the most prominent elected Republicans with links to various right-wing groups also shows how various strands of extremism came together at the Capitol building on Wednesday, 6th of January 2021. In July, Paul Gosar, a dentist, posed for a picture with a member of the Proud Boys. 2 years earlier, he spoke at a rally for a jailed leader of Britain's anti-immigrant fringe in London, where he vilified Muslim immigrants as a scourge. And in 2014, Paul Gosar traveled to Nevada to support the armed standoff between law enforcement and supporters of the cattle rancher Cliven Bundy, who had refused to stop trespassing on federal lands. Andy Biggs, the chairman of the hard-right House of Freedom Caucus, was seen by leaders of the Stop the Steal movement as an inspiration and has spoken at events hosted by various extremist groups, including one at which a founder of the Oath Keepers called for hanging Senator John McCain. Ms. Boebert of Colorado, elected to the House in November, said on Twitter that today is 1776 on the morning of Wednesday, 6th of January 2021, and she has connections to the Three Percenters extremist group, which shares her view that gun rights are under assault. At least one member of the group has been arrested in the breach of the Capitol building. Marjorie Taylor Greene has for years trafficked in conspiracy theories, expressed support for QAnon, and made offensive remarks about black people, Jews, and Muslims. She also appeared at a campaign event alongside members of the Three Percenters extremist group. To some degree, members of Congress have been reflecting signals sent by former President Donald Trump. During a presidential debate in October, he made a nod towards the Proud Boys, telling them to stand back and stand by. 2 months earlier, Donald Trump described followers of QAnon, several of whom have been charged with murder, domestic terrorism, planned kidnapping, and most recently, storming of the Capitol building, as people that love our country. Donald Trump added, "Apparently, they like me." Few Republicans have been more linked to extremist groups than Paul Gosar, a Republican congressman from Arizona. He's been involved with anti-Muslim groups and various hate groups, said Mr. Gosar's brother, Dave Gosar, a lawyer in Wyoming. He's made anti-Semitic diatribes. He's twisted up so tight with the Oath Keepers, it's not even funny. Dave Gosar, Paul Gosar's brother, and other Gosar siblings ran advertisements denouncing their brother as a dangerous extremist when he ran for Congress in 2018. Now they're calling on Congress to expel him. "We warned everybody how dangerous he was," Dave Gosar said. In the days after the 2020 election, Mr. Gosar and Mr. Biggs helped turn Arizona into a crucible for the Stop the Steal movement, finding common cause with hardliners who until then had toiled in obscurity. Like Ali Alexander, the two congressmen recorded a video, "This election is a joke," which was viewed more than a million times and spread disinformation about alleged widespread voter fraud. Mr. Alexander has said he schemed up the 6th of January rally with Paul Gosar and Andy Biggs and another vocal proponent of Stop the Steal, Representative Mo Brooks of Alabama. Mr. Alexander's characterization of the role of the members of Congress is exaggerated, Andy Biggs said, but the lawmakers were part of a larger network of people who helped plan and promote the rally as part of Donald Trump's effort to overturn the will of the American voters. After the election, Mr. Alexander emerged as a vocal proponent of the president's stolen election claims, setting up a Stop the Steal website on 4th of November and making incendiary statements. On 8th of December 2020, he tweeted that he was willing to give up his life to keep Donald Trump in office.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
European News Bulletin.
I'm your host, Saeed Pereza. We'll kick this broadcast off here in England. Calls for getting the shutting down of Napier Barracks in Kent, southeast England, to completion is getting louder, described as the UK's first unofficial refugee camp. Residents say their living conditions are becoming unbearable and social distancing amid a COVID-19 outbreak is practically impossible. Banker Rahimi has visited the camp and sent us this report.
Fake blood being washed away, hours after activists threw it at the gates of the Napier Barracks in Kent, trying to highlight human rights violations taking place here. Security was tighter than usual when we arrived, and the occupants were reluctant to come forward.
Independent organizations, charities, and the residents themselves describe conditions here at the barracks as inhumane and unbearable. This was not what asylum seekers who risked life and limb to get to British shores were expecting. There have been protests, hunger strikes, and suicide attempts.
After an outbreak of COVID-19, morale deteriorated even further. Around 28 people were sharing the same space, toilet and shower, including those who tested positive. Literally trapped, some residents have slept outside in the cold for fear of catching the virus. But the government insists the barracks are COVID-19 compliant. On January 26th, the Secretary of State for the Home Department slapped down Labour MP Zara Sultana for demanding the dignity of the residents be respected and more suitable housing arranged for them.
Because of coronavirus, we need space for social distancing, which has been absolutely in place. These accommodation sites are in line with Public Health England guidance, as we've always checked guidance and worked with PHE throughout coronavirus when it comes to accommodation. I can see the Honourable Lady shaking her head. Perhaps you'd like to listen to the facts and not some of the sort of jaded views that she may hold herself.
That said, less than 24 hours later, dozens of residents were moved out of the barracks with very short notice and taken to a hotel nearby. These men all tested negative for COVID-19, but as they made clear, they were not allowed to exit the building and talk to us, even from a safe distance. There have been reports of them being threatened with delayed responses to their asylum applications if they are too forthcoming with the media. The atmosphere was sober in Kent, and people have mixed feelings towards the asylum seekers.
This is probably going to sound very unkind to say it, but if they left for a better condition here, all right, they may not be what they were expecting, but if they were good enough for the army in the old days, the barracks, why aren't they good enough for them? And that sounds awful, I know, and I'm going to get slated for saying that, but that is my view.
They're people, you know, they're trying to have a better life. Obviously, where they're coming from, the majority of them is horrendous. So I don't know what to do. I really don't know what to do. I mean, I like to think that we're at the end of the day, we're human beings going to try and cope with this as best as we can without blaming people all the time.
I know it's war-torn places and all that, but the law says that the first country they come to, they're supposed to seek asylum, but they're not. They're just coming straight through. This is where they want to get to because it's easy pickings. We're too easy on them. Sorry, but that's my opinion of it.
In an open letter to the British people in January, the residents of Napier Barracks described their living conditions and called for compassion. These men are finding it increasingly difficult to see light at the end of the tunnel, with asylum applications in limbo and their freedom of movement curtailed even more due to the pandemic. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Brexit was a defining moment in Britain's political history, and a real opportunity, many hoped, of the UK retaking its place as a leading voice on the world stage, free from the constraints of the EU. Now, a month in, has stepping away from Brussels yielded immediate results? Amina Taylor has a closer look.
After years of campaigning, round after round of tough negotiations with the EU, deadlines pushed back, and a no deal averted in the nick of time, January the 1st was a moment of triumph for those who both supported the UK's exit from Europe and for those who simply wanted to move on from the diplomatic drama. But flash forward a month into the UK's new relationship with Europe, and even though it's still early days, how's it working out?
Brexit was touted in certain quarters as Britain's Independence Day, a real opportunity to retake sovereignty from the clutches of the European Union. But now, with some time settling in, just what are the realities of Britain's exit from the EU?
Brexit has clearly caused a lot of short-term chaos, basically, particularly with the fisheries exports and with the supply of food into this country. It's been a huge amount of disruption because of the extra red tape. The irony was that the Brexiteers said we are going to lose all these regulations and red tape and we'll be free to do things, whereas in fact there's a whole mountain of stuff that companies have to complete and all has to be correct in order for really the most basic things to happen.
Boris Johnson and his cabinet have been adamant. This is a new dawn for the UK, a genuine opportunity to flex its political muscles on the global stage. Teething problems have dented this bonhomie somewhat, with businesses trading with the EU pointing to new obstacles.
What we haven't been prepared for, and I think this applies to any business in the UK, is all the extra costs that have come from this.
Industries like fisheries have been particularly impacted, with worried businesses taking their grievance directly to Westminster.
Once the customs stuff's done, it's back onto the lorry can then leave, down for the ferry, make sure we got our import declarations done as well, onto the ferry and on the other side. Could be another 30 hours extra for the shellfish in the water. It's not feasible.
The new trade deals that will replace anything lost in the split with Brussels have yet to publicly materialise.
All this nonsense talk about sovereignty and how now we're a free and independent country. On the contrary, we had great protection within the European Union. We were in the biggest trading bloc in the world, which not only meant we could trade freely with them, but also they had clout of the EU negotiating on our behalf and on behalf of the other 27 states for trade deals with other countries in the world. Whereas these days, just imagine what China and indeed the United States will think about Little Britain coming cap in hand.
There have been political complications too, with Scotland pushing ahead stridently for another independence vote as a campaign of reunification is being talked down in Ireland by unionists. Ardent Brexiteers will say moving away from the EU is more than about the nuts and bolts of red tape and temporary obstacles, but about a return to something greater, a renewed sense of pride that you can't put a price on. But for those battling with the new realities, they may well wonder if it's a price worth paying. Amina Taylor, London.
Stay in this country, the UK has added the UAE, Burundi, and Rwanda to a list of countries from which all direct passenger flights will be banned. The aim is to stop the spread of a new potentially vaccine-resistant strain of the COVID-19 virus, first identified in South Africa. British, Irish, and third country nationals with residence rights in the UK will still be allowed to enter the country, but must self-isolate for 10 days on arrival. Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has met his Turkish counterpart in Istanbul to discuss a range of issues, including regional stability. The two countries touched on their joint efforts at maintaining peace in the Caucasus and in Syria, and also discussed the potential to work together on the situation in Afghanistan. Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Çavuşoğlu criticized ongoing Western sanctions on Iran and reiterated Turkey's support for the JCPOA, also known as the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. a new law in Poland that bans abortion is almost, in almost all cases, is proving controversial. Poland's conservative government, which has strong ties to the country's powerful Catholic Church, supported the ruling, saying an unborn child is a human being. The new law, which came into force Wednesday, will only permit abortions in the case of rape, incest, or a threat to the mother's life. Hundreds of pro-choice protesters took to the streets of Warsaw Thursday evening to demonstrate against the law, saying it imposes severe limitations on women's rights and freedoms. At least four people have reportedly been killed in a hospital fire in the Romanian capital, Bucharest. The fire broke out early Friday at the Matei Balz Hospital, where COVID-19 patients are being treated. Vaccinations are also taking place at the same hospital, which had to be completely evacuated. Switzerland is a country which holds regular referendums. However, an upcoming vote on March 7th could see Muslim women banned from wearing the Islamic face veil by law. If successful, the vote would see Switzerland become the latest European country to discriminate against Muslims in law. Robert Carter explains.
Will Switzerland ban the burqa? That is the question being asked by many Swiss Muslims ahead of an upcoming referendum, which seeks a total ban on all face coverings in public. If successful, Muslim women who wear Islamic face veils will be banned from doing so after March the 7th.
Now, the text in the proposal doesn't mention Muslim face veils per se, only stating that no one shall wear face coverings in public spaces. However, the group behind the proposal includes members of right-wing political parties who were behind the already successful bid to ban Islamic minarets from being erected across the country in 2009.
In response, local Muslim activists have begun a Save the Niqab campaign to challenge the hate.
Islamophobia is as spread in Switzerland as everywhere in Europe. We know that there is a realistic chance for the Niqab ban to be passed.
Speaking to Press TV, a representative explained why the ban would set a dangerous precedent.
Since the referendum was already signed by more than 100,000 voters to be even admitted at the to the ballot, and the recent poll suggests that 64% of voters will vote in favor of a ban, the law is highly to be passed. Adding such an Islamophobic and discriminatory ban to the Swiss constitution, which dictates to women how they should dress, exposes Switzerland to internal, or I would say international ridicule, and fundamentally contradicts the liberal and pluralistic values that this country is so fond of propagating. And if we were to ban everything that might been out of force, then we would most likely ban a lot of things, and not only the niqab.
Islamophobia has penetrated deep into Swiss society, with a recent poll finding that 63% of those questioned would vote in favor of a burqa ban, leaving Swiss Muslims with little hope. Robert Carter, London.
Fellow Russian President Alexander Lukashenko has supported Moscow's detention of Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny.
All those investigations by this fugitive, who was accepted back in Russia, this German protester, that's just the beginning. And to him, I want to say, if anybody decides to fight, especially against the powers, against the government, against the president, decides to combat corruption, you better be crystal clean yourself.
Western-backed Navalny was detained for violating his parole in an embezzlement case. He is also on trial on assault charges, which he says are politically motivated. In other news, China has announced it'll no longer recognize the British National Overseas Passport as a valid travel document or form of identification. The decision comes amid a bitter feud with London over a plan to allow millions of Hong Kong residents a route to UK residency and eventual citizenship. Under the plan, as many as 5.4 million Hong Kong residents could be eligible to live and work in the UK. Hong Kong is a former British colony, which China reclaimed in 1997.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we cover the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
That time of the broadcast, outrage and fury at trading services such as Robinhood that have put blocks on trading the shares of U.S.-based retailer GameStop, which has had a meteoric rise to more than $300 per share. The move has drawn the ire of celebrities, entrepreneurs, and politicians such as American Congresswoman AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Ahmed Caballo joins me now to break it down for us. Ahmed, what is this David against Goliath situation?
Yes, David versus Goliath is an apt description. Some are calling this a revolution on Wall Street, the little man fighting back against hedge fund billionaires. And it all centers around something called short selling or shorting, which involves hedge funds betting on stocks that are struggling to lose their value and a way to make money off them. Now, GameStop, which was struggling before the pandemic, was seen as a prime target. However, there was this group called Wall Street Bets, which is on the social media platform Reddit, who have en masse bought the shares of GameStop, forced it to rise up, and basically forced these hedge funds and these billionaires to lose money. And in normal circumstances, they tell us that we live in a free market where all's fair in love and war. But these billionaires have not lied down lightly, and they've used their influence to force 212 trading app, Robinhood, and a series of other apps to stop you being able to buy this share, meaning and only allowing you to sell, which has obviously caused the price to fall down. Now, it's a bit more complicated than that. We've got a video from Dave Fortney, who's going to explain a bit more.
What is going on Wall Street? The way they have absolutely cheated, stolen, robbed everyday people who have been investing with Robinhood and other E-Trade accounts and all this stuff by saying, hey, hedge funds are getting smoked. Billionaires are getting smoked. So we're no longer going to let you trade on certain stocks, GMC, AMC, NOC. We're just shutting it off. You can't buy those stocks anymore. You can only sell them. We are going to crash those stocks so all our hedge fund billionaire friends can get out and not get killed. It is one of the most remarkable, illegal, shocking robberies in the history, in plain sight.
So basically, Robinhood and the like protecting the billionaires.
Protecting the billionaires. And this happened yesterday, and because of the backlash against what Robinhood and these other apps were doing, they were forced today to open limited trades on GameStop. But not everyone agrees. We do have those that represent the interests of the billionaire class that think that what these ordinary people were doing by buying stocks was not right. So let's play that video of someone who's complaining about ordinary people buying stocks and forcing billionaires to lose money.
The New York Stock Exchange does. So if anybody was going to control the listing and shut it down, it should have been them, but it wasn't. It was you. And the reason that they do it is very limited. They do it because they think there's evidence of fraud, or they think that there needs to be a material disclosure by the company that hasn't been made. And that's done to protect the investor. You check none of those boxes here because you don't control the venue. You didn't know about any information that GameStop or any of these other stocks needed to put out. You don't have any reason to believe there's fraud that you've articulated. And you're certainly not protecting these people who've been living the dream of making money, especially at the expense of the big guys. So why should people believe you did this for the right reasons?
Well, we have no choice. We have to comply with all financial requirements. And
the SEC hasn't said you had to do this.
Well, lots of brokers have to...
Good question there. Why should people believe you did this for the right reasons?
Yeah, that was a wrong video. That was actually Christopher Kumi from CNN. He was drilling the Robinhood CEO, Vlad Tenev, about what he's done. And as you could see, he was umming and ahhing, and he didn't really have an explanation for what he did or why he did it. And there is no explanation, there is no justification. It seems like that this was done at the behest of those who have a lot of money and therefore have a lot of influence. Now, we are going to play the video of someone complaining on behalf of the billionaires that we were meant to play a moment ago. Let's play that.
The reason the market is doing what it's doing is people are sitting at home getting the checks from the government, okay? And this fair share is a concept. It's just a way of attacking wealthy people, and, you know, I think it's inappropriate. We all got to work together and pull together.
If people are trying to make money, he calls it a way of attacking wealthy people.
Yeah, exactly. Now, because of the uproar on social media, this has been one of the number one trending topics for the last 24 hours. We've had some backlash from politicians. We've got this tweet from AOC. She says, got to admit, it's really something to see Wall Streeters with a long history of treating our economy as a casino complain about a message board of posters also treating the market as a casino. And some people are mentioning that the 2008 crash was not a result of people on Reddit. It was a result of these hedge fund billionaires who were basically gambling with everyone's future, gambling with people's mortgages, gambling with people's welfare and their livelihoods. Now, Joe McCain says this, this is how the system is rigged. The elites aren't even trying to hide it. Robinhood, whose revenue is largely tied to Citadel, restricts trading in GME, AMC, and NOK, which is Nokia. Users can only sell, not buy. Now, this is one of the rumors online. It hasn't been verified yet, but some of these hedge funds, one of them is Citadel, there is allegations they have financial links to some of these apps that have taken this decision to stop trading for these stocks. Now, final tweet from Rep. Jeff Duncan says this. Tonight, I'm leading a bipartisan group of lawmakers.